Hi everybody, it's Bikescape, episode number 47, August 2nd, 2007. Everybody, welcome to Bikescape, episode 47. Moving right along. As you know, or may not know, Bikescape comes from San Francisco, California, and we cover a lot of local things that are happening, various bike protests or bike rides and whatnot. But this episode, I want to begin the first of a series of shows that concern bicycling elsewhere in the world. And today, it's the UK. We're going to talk about bicycling in the UK, and we have two long interviews. An interview with the preeminent podcaster and broadcaster of bicycle radio in London, The Bike Show, from Resonance FM. Jack Thurston will be talking to us. And after that, you may want to take a break. I think I'll put in a little fun stuff and some music. And then we're going to go to Josh Hart, who is my old buddy. You may have heard him in an earlier podcast. He's studying urban planning over there in Bristol, and he has his own perspective on critical mass in Bristol, then the renascent critical mass in Bristol, as well as many other things that are happening. And he has a very unique perspective about a lot of things. So let's go first to Jack Thurston in London.
All right, well, we're here with Jack Thurston of The Bike Show in London. Tell me about your show. What is it that makes your show different from the other shows? In the bicycle-oriented show. There's so many of them these days.
Well, there are. But our show began in 2004 on a very small and little-known radio station called Resonance FM, which is London's first radio art station. I guess it might be similar to your kind of college radio stations over in the United States, but it's not affiliated with any university or anything like that. But it's essentially a non-profit radio station broadcasting on a fairly limited FM license in central London. And its mission is to bring art to the airwaves. And I approached them with the idea of doing a bicycling radio show. And it was just a one-off, actually. During the Tour de France of 2004, I thought it would be fun and to look at a lot of the connections between art and cycling and society and culture. And they said, yeah, sure, do it. And then I did that, and then I did another one. And then I got the idea to do a weekly half hour. And that started in December of 2004. And it's been going on and off. I sort of run in seasons on the show. So seasons of sort of 6 to 9 or 10 weeks. And what developed in the show was particular kind of interview, which I enjoyed doing, which was interviewing people who had some kind of tangential connection with cycling. It could be that they were working with bicycle advocacy. It could be they were an artist who just happened to ride a bike, or a musician. And we would ride around town, and I would interview them whilst riding, and we'd capture all the sounds of the city. And it turned into quite an interesting format for an interview. And we'd, you know, added bits of music and bits of sounds, and that's how it developed, really. And then about 6 months after we'd been broadcasting on FM, a guy up in Scotland said, well, why don't you podcast this? And I was like, well, what's a podcast? I'm a bit scared of that. And he helped me sort it out. And so in May, we started putting the show online as an MP3. And so anybody could listen to it, and it was sort of available all the time as an archived show, as well as being on the FM signal in central London. So that's really, now we've done about 75 shows or something like that.
Good Lord. Would you say that you have more listeners from the podcast than you do? Do you have any kind of numbers?
Well, we don't know. I mean, the Resonance reaches up 2 million people, in theory, in the central London area. Mm. How many of them actually tune in, I don't know. The people who run the station say that they think it's about 160 60, 150, 160,000 people a month will listen at some point or other to Resonance, but the bike show is only half an hour a week.
Right.
And so I don't know. But in terms of the podcast, it's downloaded by around about 1,500 people every week, although that goes up and down depending on, you know, whether people decide that they like the look of that episode when it pops up in iTunes. Yeah. And they say hit and hit that and download it. But yeah, I think the podcast has been really interesting because it's opened the show to a lot of people who couldn't listen or wouldn't listen because they don't live in London and listen in London with a radio listening to Resonance FM. So they find it a different way. They find it through iTunes or they find it through just browsing the web. And it's become, you know, it's become a little feature on the bicycling scene. And people now, when I say to them, can I talk to you? I make the bike show on Resonance FM. They go, oh yeah, I've heard that, or I've heard of that. We won the best media award in the London Cycling Awards a couple of years ago.
Why don't you tell me about why you do a bike show, and what place in bike culture do you occupy in London, and what is the bike culture? How did it happen? If you wanted to do a show about bicycling,
well,
and not like electronics or something.
I thought it would be. I mean, I like to ride a bike. It's a really fun part of my week, riding a bicycle, and it happens every day because, you know, I don't drive a car and I don't like to ride on public transport so much because it costs a lot in London and it's not very reliable. And I just like being out on a bicycle. I like going in the countryside. I like cycling over mountains. I'm not particularly sporty, although I've done a few triathlons. So it's always been a part of something that I've enjoyed. And I just thought it would be a great idea for a radio show. I just thought there was that unmet need. You know, there are lots of radio shows about all kinds of different things. I mean, we've got TV shows over here about cars, but really nothing broadcasting on bicycles. And I just thought, well, this is going to be something that will work. And I've been amazed that I've managed to churn out, you know, 75 half-hour shows over the 2.5 years, because the material has just come forward. And particularly because Resonance is an art station, I've just found there's been this enormous overlap between arts and culture and society and the bicycle. And I don't know whether it's because a lot of artists ride bikes because they don't have any money, or whether they ride bikes because they actually like the physical experience of riding a bike, the excitement, the visual stimulation that you get that you don't get when you're on the tube, or you don't get when you're on a bus that's got steamed up windows and loads of teenagers kind of harassing you. But on a bicycle, you're free, you can drop in here, you can change your route, you can explore. And I think that very much relates to the inquiring, curious, creative mind of the artist. And so it's been actually no trouble finding lots of great things to talk about. And as far as, you know, where the bike show fits into London bicycle culture, I mean, I'm not sure if there is a London bicycle culture. I think it's very much like it is in San Francisco or in New York, that you've got lots of different little subgroups and probably a lot of people that wouldn't even consider themselves to be in a group of cyclists. You know, they just ride a bike, you know. And whether you can say that there's something in common between the bicycle messenger who has got the dreadlocks and the enormous New York lock around their waist and all the body piercings and the tattoos and the fixed gear track bike, and the suited man who arrives at Waterloo Station from you know, somewhere out in the home counties with his Brompton folding bicycle folded up and just quickly flips it out, and he's wearing his suit and his tie and he puts his helmet on and rides to the 2 miles to work. I don't know whether there's a lot of affinity. I like to think that there is. I like to think that when you're stopped at the red lights, you know, there are some cyclists in London who do stop at red lights, but when you're stopped at the red lights and you look to the side of you, you feel that there is some kind of esprit de corps, some kind of shared values, with even if it's, you know, the 10% of it, the reason why you bicycle. So you know, we have a lot of bicycle commuters, people who get to work on a bike. We have a small number of kind of competitive cyclists that you see around, you know, people who are racing and doing triathlons and things like that. And then, yeah, obviously you've got the hipsters and the messenger scene and BMXers and stunt bike people, kids mm-hmm. who enjoy doing that kind of stuff. But I think you don't probably have quite so many of like older generation folks like you do in Paris or Amsterdam or Berlin, you know, just riding around. So you definitely do make a choice to ride a bike. It's not an automatic thing to do in London. Whereas I think in some of those cities, Copenhagen, it really is an automatic thing to do. That, you know, why wouldn't you be riding a bike? But right. We've seen huge changes in London in the last few years. I think it's something like a 70% increase in the number of cyclists in the last 5 years. Part of that has been to do with the congestion charge, which is this policy that was very controversially brought in by the mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, in the teeth of opposition from the central government, who thought this was going to be a disaster, this was going to be a vote loser, this was going to be a real problem.
But there was a lot of opposition from storekeepers and residents as well.
There was a lot of opposition. There was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of skepticism about whether they'd be able to get the computers working right, because the way it works is London is a very porous centre. You know, you've got lots of roads that filter into London. You can't just establish a kind of gateway and charge people as they come in. The idea is to charge them a fixed fee for every day that you drive in the very centre of London. And that fee
was initially
£5 for a day, and that was raised recently to £8. And it was just the central part of London. So I don't quite know the size of the area, but probably about a kind of 4 square miles, maybe, or a bit less. It's since been enlarged westwards to take in areas of Chelsea and Kensington.
All the rich neighbourhoods
and the rich neighbourhoods. That's a kind of has a double-edged sword, because if you live within the zone, you get a 90% discount on the charge, which mm-hmm. is a pretty hefty discount. You only have to pay 10% of the charge if you buy the annual ticket. And that means that now they've enlarged the zone, a whole lot of new people qualify for this residence discount, which means that they can kind of go as they please. But it has definitely reduced the amount of car travel in the centre of London, and that there's some debate about it. It's also raised a lot of money for buses. Because all the money that was raised, all the profit, you know, once they paid all the technology costs, the profit would be devoted to improving the bus network, and that has definitely paid off, and the buses are a lot better now than they used to be. But the technology is pretty sophisticated. You know, they've got cameras all throughout the city, particularly at the entrance points that read your number plate of your car, and then send that number into the giant brain of the congestion charge, which checks whether your car has been paid for that day, and you have up until 10 p.m. at night to make your payment. And you can do it anywhere. You can do it by text messaging, you can do it by going into a little corner store and handing over your money, or you can do it on the web, or, you know, they make it very easy for you to pay. But it definitely has seemed to just make people think, do I need to make this journey by car? And it's been the little nudge that I think a lot of people have needed to tip them into thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to get a bicycle.
So do you think that in the face of all the opposition, it's been successful for the most part?
It's been absolutely successful.
And people are happy with it now.
People, mm-hmm. there's the opposition to it is you don't hear it much. People are happy with it. They just see that it's a sensible thing. And actually, if you look at that, you know, you say, well, it's quite a lot, £8 to drive in central London. Well, you'll probably pay that much in parking, because there's not a lot of free parking in central London. So, you know, it's already an expensive proposition to bring a car into central London. This, in a sense, just, you know, seals the deal. And people just don't think to do it so much. Or they do bite the bullet and buy the annual pass, but that's about £2,000. I wonder whether they'll increase it by more. I mean, there are plans, and the mayor has mentioned these plans last week, that he wants to increase the charge to £25, which is, you know, at the current exchange rate, that's pushing on for $50 for the kind of 4x4 SUV type vehicles, because these are seen as the ones that are, first of all, worst for congestion because they take up a lot more width in the road. We don't have very wide roads in London, so if you've got, if you're driving around in a Hummer, you really are making it difficult for scooters and cycles and other road users. You're blocking up the way, and you're also pumping out a lot more carbon dioxide and other pollutants. And so there is this plan to charge these Chelsea tractors, is the London expression for SUV, to charge them a £25 fee, which that would be pretty heroic if they did it, because we are seeing an increase in the use of these vehicles, even though gasoline, petrol is much more expensive than it is in the US. It's, you know, it's about £1 a litre, and so it's pushing on for, I don't know, $7 or $8 a gallon, probably.
Right,
equivalent.
That seems like to me the tipping point around about right about that price. When we hit that price, I think that's when we're going to.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's really difficult to tell. I think people can get used to almost anything if they're not imaginative enough to think of an alternative. They can get used to almost anything, and it, you know.
On the bright side, though, I've been reading that in London or England in general, Great Britain has been going through a great renaissance of cycling among all different kinds of people. And I don't know if it's because of the congestion charging making things the streets a little safer, maybe a convergence of the terrorist attacks. People couldn't ride the tube for a while.
People certainly
have
didn't
you noticed
fancy,
a lot of people, right?
They didn't. People, the 7th of July bombings, people didn't fancy getting into a tube because they've you know, seen what happened, and if
the tube is what we call a subway.
The subway, yeah. They didn't feel like going underground into a underground subway car because of what happened with these guys who blew up the subway cars, and they blew up a bus as well. And people, right. So people just didn't fancy that. But you know, then there was a lot of backlash saying, "Well, actually, you're 100 times more likely to be hit on a bicycle than you are to be blown up by a, you know, Islamic death cult terrorist." So, you know, that's a debate, and I think it's one of those things that it's difficult to see why people do it. But I think when the sunshine comes out, people dust down their bicycle and have a go, and then the big question is, do they keep doing it? Do they stay on the roads? Do they stay on the roads when it rains a little bit, or when it gets a little bit colder? That's the key question. It's getting people from the once or twice a year to actually seeing it as a regular thing. And I think the more and more people there are on the road, the more visible bicyclists become, the more strength in numbers there is, that sense of safety of being in a constant stream of bicycles going over Waterloo Bridge nearby where I live in the morning, it's phenomenal. And I, on the show, we had a debate about a year and a half ago about critical mass, because we have a critical mass here, and then there was a very, very, very big one in October of 2006, because in one of the summer ones, the police had issued a kind of injunction saying this is an organised protest, but it's not allowed because it hasn't been approved, because there hasn't been an agreed route, and all this kind of thing, and an agreed leadership.
Sounds familiar.
And all this kind of stuff, and people say, well, critical mass is not like an organised thing, we don't know where it's going to go, there's no leaders, and the police couldn't really handle that, so they kind of made a blanket ban, or they proposed to make a blanket ban, or proposed to do some arrests, and then just tons of people turned out as the response to that. And I went along on it, and it was, you know, a few thousand people, and it really blocked up the centre of London on a Friday evening. And a lot of us just thought, hang on, this is not what we need anymore in London. We have so many people on bikes now. We don't need to stop people getting home on the buses. We don't need to jam up the city. We just don't. That's the kind of the past era, and there obviously are still people who like critical mass and enjoy it as a sociable ride. But I did feel that it was often being hijacked for other causes. So people would take it to a gas station and, like, you know, do a sit-in in a Shell station to protest about whatever was going on in Nigeria, or they would take it to the American embassy and then, like, you know, be a kind of anti-Iraq war. And, you know, and I'm as anti the Iraq war as the next person in the UK, but I don't see that that that's what you should be doing with a sociable bicycle ride, then you are becoming a protest, and then you do have to change the terms of the way it happens. And I think we've gone beyond the need for a critical mass in London. I think you're having a critical mass every day, particularly when the sun shines. And so that's the way I see it. And there's been a lot around the rest of the country as well, although I think it's these areas, the sort of peri-urban fringe, the suburban areas, are still very unfriendly for cycling. Big roads, not much cycle provision. Central London is good, central Bristol is good, some of the bigger cities, and then obviously if you're touring in the countryside, it's utterly wonderful all throughout all the lanes that you've got crisscrossing the United Kingdom. It's wonderful. But I think in the suburban areas, it's still, you know, very much a non-conventional choice to ride a bicycle. And so, but you know, what happens in the centre of London often conditions what happens in the rest of the country. But I don't know whether that'll happen.
What are some big events that are coming up?
You know, there are various rides, that sort of organised rides that happen. There's a big Cycle Sportive coming up. There's a sort of growing movement of these cyclosportives, which is a sort of continental thing that has been imported to the UK, which is like kind of it's like a organized ride, usually with some kind of meaning attached to it, or some kind of geographic place that's interesting, or it follows the route of a race of professional riders, and it's not a kind of sponsored ride, so there's no, you know, raising money for pandas or whatever involved. It's just a day out, but it's not like a race. Although there are prizes awarded, you know, within certain categories. So it's a sort of a cross between a race and a day out ride. And there's a lot of those coming on the calendar around the country, and that's a lot of fun. And there's going to be a big one from London to Canterbury a week before the Tour de France riders ride from London to Canterbury. There'll be a ride for over 5,000 cyclists riding from London. And I just that got booked out in 36 hours of the online entries being opened, and I didn't.
You have to buy a ticket.
Well, in theory, you have to buy a ticket, and that allows you to get like a number and a chip on your leg that gives you a time and all that kind of stuff. But I've been talking to a few friends, and I think we're just going to go along and do it because how can they stop you? You know, they're not closing the roads for the ride. So it's not as if they can say these roads are for the exclusive use of people. You know, maybe you'll get turned away at the feed stations or something like that, and they won't give you a flapjack or a, you know, bottle of Gatorade or whatever, and you won't get the T-shirt. But you know, I think you'll be along for the ride.
Hey, tell me about the Dunwich Dynamo ride.
Yeah, the Dunwich Dynamo is going to have its 15th birthday, and this is a ride which began, 15 years ago, and it's a ride which goes from London, from East London, Hackney, to the Suffolk coast, which is kind of northeast of London, and it's 200 kilometres, so about 120 miles. But the interesting thing about this ride is that it starts at 9 o'clock at night on the Saturday night nearest the full moon in July. You aim for a moonlit night, and you ride under the stars, and it's just a turn up and go ride. You can pay £1 to get a little route direction thing printed on a piece of paper, but there's no mechanics wagon. Again, there's no sponsorship, there's no saving money for pandas or, you know, any kind of charitable cause involved. It's just riding, and it's just riding with people, and you know, who turn up and do it. You don't have to book a place or anything. And then there's halfway along, there's a feeding stop with some lovely people in a village in Essex who put on a really good meal for everybody. And you know, that costs, you know, a couple of pounds. That's all, you know, big veggie pasta and a banana and a cup of tea and things like that. And then you arrive at the beach at Dunwich at dawn, and people arrive anywhere between 6 o'clock in the morning for the real fast people, or 5:30 in the morning, up till, you know, 11 o'clock for people who've really taken their time or had a mechanical along the way, or got waylaid in a pub or something like that. And you know, you can just run down the beach and jump into the sea, and then everyone just hangs around and has a breakfast and go and have a drink, have a snooze, and then comes back. I mean, some people ride back, the truly, you know, hardy people who've just ridden 120 miles will then just ride 120 miles back. And but a lot of people just take a coach back. And last year, around about 750 people did the ride, which is phenomenal. And it's just an amazing sight, seeing this trail of flashing red LEDs stretching out in front of you into the distance. Really beautiful, really magical. Although there was tragedy last year where one of the riders was killed by a van of a guy who was just driving really irresponsibly. I think he'd just been in the pub, and he took a corner, like going onto the other side of the road where he shouldn't have been, and he just plowed into this guy, and who was just killed instantly. So that was really terrible. So that's hopefully not going to overshadow things, because I'm sure the man who died wouldn't want for the, you know, the ride to stop. He was a very passionate, committed cyclist. But, you know, handling that is going to be difficult, I think, emotional for some people. And obviously, you know, you desperately don't want that kind of thing to happen again. But what can you do against people who are driving their vehicles badly? You know, it really wasn't, there was no fault on the part of the bicyclist. I think the person who killed the guy was found guilty in the court and got some ridiculous sentence. Like, I don't know if it was a year or something like that, for, you know, homicide, manslaughter, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, it's still, the English legal system means that if you want to kill somebody, the way to do it and get the lightest sentence from the law is to do it using a car, because that's the way that you get forgiven by the law. If you murder someone, if you stab someone, if you shoot someone, if you strangle someone, you know, you get sent down for a long period of time. If you run somebody over, you know, a couple of years maximum.
Well, even if you happen to just walk down the street shooting a gun in the air, if you happen to hit somebody through a window and kill them, you'll pay the consequences for that. But if you drive erratically, it's true. That's true all over the world. Well, I thought the Danish Dynamo was the show you did about that was probably the best one you did, or my favorite anyway,
right,
because you were able to capture that entire the whole zeitgeist of the ride, and, you know, with the sound and the music, and it came out really well.
Yeah, that was a fun one, and I kept falling behind my friends who I was riding with because I was stopping to record things. And it's funny, you know, you're riding through the night on a Saturday night, and you go through these deserted, quiet villages where everybody's asleep, or occasionally you'll go past a marquee in somebody's garden where there's a kind of wedding reception going on, and there's some bad karaoke and dancing, and you just have these glimpses into another life, which is just fascinating. And you feel like you're on, you know, stolen time somehow. You're stealing time from the world because you're cycling through the night. It's there's something very magical. I did a few night rides last year, and it's something that I got really into. And I'm actually at the moment writing an article for a new cycling magazine called Rouleur, which is, I think it's just had its fifth edition, but it's a kind of really high end magazine that's got beautiful photography and hopefully some good writing. And I did an article about the German electropop band Kraftwerk and their obsession with bicycling. And so it's that, you know, it's, where else in the media can you write a 3,000 word article about that, you know, and get it printed in a beautiful magazine? So I'm writing something about night rides. An interesting night ride, or an interesting ride that goes through the night, is the Paris-Brest-Paris ride, which is, you know, a legendary ride that happens every 4 years. This is a ride that starts in Paris, the French capital, and goes to all the way to Brest in Brittany, and then comes all the way back. And that is, I think, over 1,000 kilometers.
That's not a social ride. That's randonneuring, really.
Well, that's a randonnée. Yeah, that's a randonnée, and there are one or two people I know who are going to be trying their hand on that one, and they're already in their training to do their sort of 400 kilometer Audax ride and the 600 kilometer to qualify. But there's going to be some interesting stories back from that, because that only happens every 4 years, so that's exciting. And then I think there's just going to be more and more people out on the street. We've got the naked bike ride that happens in June, which is quite a lot of fun. You've got that too. I imagine that's kind of a little bit more in keeping with the sort of San Francisco flowers in your hair, body painting scene that you have, that tradition that you guys have. Whereas in London, we're a little bit more, you know, body conscious, and the nudity is like, we're terribly English. What are we doing?
Yeah, I think the flowers, and I think we've, black leather has taken the place of flowers and body paint here. Thank you very much for being on Bikescape. It's been a real honor to have you on the show.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thanks, John.
Cars by the Desperate Bicycles, an old punk band out of the mid-70s in London. Introduced to me by my kindred spirit, the kindred spirit of Bikescape, Jack Thurston from The Bike Show in London, Resonance FM. Go check him out. Excellent show. Now let's turn our attention to the left coast of England, the home of Josh Hart, who left us here in San Francisco to go study urban planning in Bristol. And he's got a unique take on environmental politics in England. He's been spending a lot of time studying how to put together cities that are more livable than the cities we have nowadays. And he's able to look at England as an outsider. So let's get on the phone with Josh.
So hi, Josh.
Hi, John. How are you? Thanks for having me on Bikescape.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So tell me about what made you go out to Bristol anyway? Why did you leave San Francisco and go to Bristol, England?
Well, it was hard, I tell you, leaving San Francisco and the great culture and bike culture that exists there. But for like 10 years, I've been wanting to get a master's degree in planning, specifically transport planning. And I've been kind of shopping around for different programs and found this one in Bristol in the United Kingdom at the University of the West of England, which is based here in Bristol. And they have this new kind of center called the Center for Transport and Society, which is looking at transport in a much different way than has been traditionally researched and taught. Traditionally, you know, you basically learn to become an engineer, how to widen a road, to solve a traffic congestion problem. This program is focused much more on the psychological and sociological elements of transport planning. So basically what's happened here in the United Kingdom is that they've shifted from a kind of a predict and provide approach, where they predicted the amount of traffic that a road would require and then provided the number of lanes that would meet that demand. And they kind of realized in the late 90s, there was a report that came out that showed that widening roads really just induced more traffic to come and didn't really solve the problem. And the guy that was primarily responsible for that report, Phil Goodwin, is here in Bristol teaching. So I came to Bristol basically to study this kind of new alternative approach and to learn how to change people's travel behavior and about kind of why things are the way they are.
I guess it was in England also that they someone wrote a paper about, they discovered the idea that when you take away road space, traffic actually doesn't get rerouted somewhere, but it actually sort of evaporates.
Exactly. It's called disappearing traffic, and yeah. they've observed this.
That's a technical term.
Yeah. Yeah, more than 100 times. It's amazing that, you know, if you close down a bridge or you shut down traffic. And an example of this is, I guess, what just happened in the Bay Area when that tanker truck melted down part of the freeway in the East Bay. The media was like, it's going to be a traffic disaster and everything's going to grind to a halt. And as a result, of course, people adjusted their travel behavior and they either combined trips or they took an earlier trip or later, or, you know, they basically made adjustments. And as we can see in a lot of different examples, traffic doesn't behave like water, like it's been assumed for so long, or electricity. It's made up of people who are psychological beings and complex beings and make adjustments to reality. And so the new kind of... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the new kind of mode of transport planning is much more to do with looking at people's psychologies, and habits, how are habits formed and how are they maintained and how to break those habits and encourage new behaviors.
So you had to go all the way to the UK to find this. You couldn't find anything like this in the United States.
Well, as far as I know, I mean, I also wanted to kind of go back to the UK where I grew up until I was 3 and half my family lives, and I have roots back here, and so I wanted to kind of reestablish those roots, and it was a good opportunity. And also, I wanted to be closer to Europe because I know that, there's a lot of really innovative infrastructure being developed and a lot of innovative programs running here as far as cycling goes. And what I kind of didn't realize, and what's really come home to me since I've been in Bristol, is that the UK really is not the European, Europe. It's a very different thing. Basically, there's a lot lower levels of cycling in the UK than there are in the EU. Some countries like the Netherlands and Denmark and Germany have prioritized bicycling in cities, where a lot of cities in the UK have kind of let their bicycling program slide. And that's beginning to be reversed, and we've certainly seen an expansion of cycling in London. And there are certainly high points. I think 20% of trips are made by bicycle in Cambridge. I think it's about 15% in Oxford. It's not bad, definitely. But these high points of cycling rates in the UK are basically what the average is in places like the Netherlands and Denmark. So basically, the UK has followed the US and our bad example as far as planning goes, building these out-of-town shopping centers that are only reachable by car, undertaking low-density suburban land development that basically makes anything but driving seem really unattractive. And so... it's definitely not as cycle friendly as I kind of assumed from grouping it in with Europe, the UK, but there's definitely positive points to it. I mean, here in Bristol, which is actually a lot like San Francisco, it's in the west of the country, it's got kind of a liberal tendencies. It's a hilly city, and there's some great, pathways. There's the pathway that goes from Bristol to Bath. It's an old rail trail. It goes about 10 miles. It's a beautiful, beautiful route. And then there's some tough points. There's incomplete cycle networks. The bike lanes go in and out, and suddenly it's not a consistent network here, as it's beginning to be in San Francisco. The cars park on the sidewalks. Here they call them pavements, but there's a lot of sidewalk parking here, and it's often difficult to walk around. So, I think the car dependence here in Bristol is particularly bad because the public transport system is so dreadful, and a lot of people don't see that they have any option other than to drive, and as a result, we see horrific congestion, poor air quality, same story. You see a lot of other places.
What about the bike culture there?
There's a strong bike culture, and it's growing. Yeah, there is the Bristol Cycling Campaign, which is the organization fighting for cyclist rights, much like the San Francisco Bike Coalition. It doesn't have a paid coordinator, and the membership numbers are rather low. But it's beginning to gain interest and clout. There's a critical mass ride that's been happening on and off for the last few years, but it's just been recently gaining strength. Last month it was about 120 people, I think, in Bristol. And there's a lot more people riding in Bristol on the Gloucester Road, which is kind of a main kind of shopping road, going north from the city center.
How many people live in the, what's the population of Bristol?
I believe it's about 400,000 for the larger, kind of greater Bristol area.
Okay, so that's a good size critical mass. I mean, it's not huge, but in proportion.
Yeah. It's definitely been building. And I think, once the word gets out and people know that it's happening every month, it gets bigger, you see a lot of people riding and commuting on their bicycles, despite the kind of lack of a consistent, continuous network here.
What other kind of events are happening there that you've been participating in? I know you've been busy with school, but what kind of political events have happened?
Well, one of the biggest things that we're fighting here locally is the proposed expansion of Bristol International Airport, and it's something that I picked up on and was involved in when I came to visit last year. Basically, you know, the demand for short-haul flights has been increasing rapidly in Europe as a whole, and led by, you know, the kind of financial success, at least of Ryanair and EasyJet. You know, you can fly from Bristol to, you know, Rome for like a 10p or something, you know, less than a pound. It's really twisted, actually, because they don't charge tax on aviation fuel. And a lot of other reasons, but basically they want to expand the airport. They want to have more flights, and this is, you know, just completely outrageous given the fact that scientists are really getting more and more certain about climate change.
And that Europe has such a great train system.
Europe does, and you know, there's this channel tunnel that connects directly to Paris and Brussels, and you can take onward high speed trains throughout Europe, you know, on the high speed European network. And so there really is no good excuse to fly. Unfortunately, it is cheaper because of this kind of obscene inconsistencies in the tax system. And so a lot of people respond to that. You know, they want to just get out of town quickly, and they want to get out of town at low cost. But there are definitely rail alternatives, and more and more people are actually taking trains to get to the destinations. So, and there has been recently a small downturn in the number of people taking short-haul flights. And some environmentalists are speculating that it is because of this increased awareness of the climate impact of flying.
So let me play devil's advocate. Wait, isn't flying that public transport? What's wrong with flying? I like to fly. I like to travel. Why shouldn't I do?
Well, I did too. I mean, I do. I'd love to travel, and I've flown a lot in my life, including, you know, many times back and forth across the Atlantic to see my family. And I didn't really quite comprehend how bad flying is for the environment until a couple of years ago, when I learned that one transatlantic flight, in other words, the emissions that you're responsible for, just you sitting in your airplane seat across the Atlantic, is the equivalent of driving a car, you know, all year, 10,000 miles for driving in your car. So in one fell swoop, an 8-hour flight across the Atlantic, you can do the same damage to the climate as you would do all year driving in your car, which just kind of bowled me over. You know, all the I gave up my car, I felt so good about it, and cycling everywhere, and then to just have all that undone by one long-haul flight a year is just too much. It was too much for me to handle, and so that's what led me to give up flying, and what led me to seek alternatives to get to the UK, which I did, and I took Amtrak to New York and then to Montreal, and I hopped on a freighter, a container ship, to Europe, and then arrived in London without using a plane. It did take me 3 weeks, and it did cost me a bit more. And, you know, in the end, obviously container ships aren't, you know, clean things. They burn this horrible bunker fuel and put quite a lot of carbon themselves into the atmosphere. But I did feel like aviation is poised to become a real impact on the climate. Right now, I think it's something like 2 or 3% of emissions. That could increase to 15 to 20% of emissions within about 15, 20 years. And the rate that short-haul flights are expanding here in the UK, it's like 5% a year. And that means a doubling in 15 years. So, and combine that with what's called radiative forcing, which is basically when you release carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide and all these things high up in the atmosphere, they have a greater effect than if you release them at ground level. So all this combined, and aviation begins to look like a real disaster for our attempts to limit our carbon emissions.
So what's going to happen at Heathrow Airport this summer?
Well, in response to this kind of threat that aviation poses, you know, and but by the way, Bristol International Airport is not alone in these airport expansions. The government is proposing you know, expanding airports across the board, from Heathrow to Gatwick to Stansted, all over the country. There are airport expansions proposed, and as a response, I should back up and say last year was the first climate camp or camp for climate action that occurred in Yorkshire in the north, and that was at Drax Power Station, which is the biggest coal burning power station in Europe. And by itself, Drax was, put out more carbon than many small countries do. So it was a significant source of carbon. And the Camp for Climate Action was basically a week-long camp. Last year, about 600 people came, and there was a series of workshops and practical symposiums and discussions and poetry slams and music making and all sorts of kind of cultural opportunities for exchanging information and advice and learning how to live in more sustainable ways. And then all of this kind of culminated in this one day of action, of direct action to shut down Drax Power Station. They're actually trying to shut it down, and kind of half succeeded in a way. They stopped coal shipments from coming in, and there were a lot of arrests, and of course, it's nonviolent direct action. So this year in August, from the 14th to the 21st, the Camp for Climate Action is planned to happen at Heathrow, and Heathrow wants to expand. They want another terminal. They want another runway. There are serious environmental implications to that, including local air quality that's already not consistent with the law, as well as climate impacts. And they basically have to like take out two or three 500-year-old villages to make this happen. So basically, the camp is going to happen within two or 3 miles of Heathrow. And they expect between 1,000 and 2,000 people to be there, and it's really a chance to for people to get up off their ass and really put into reality some of the concerns they have. 'Cause it's so easy to get depressed and despairing about climate change. It's a huge issue, but this is something practical you can do, and it should be a really amazing, amazing week. I encourage anyone who's going to be over here for that time to come to the Camp for Climate Action. I think it's climatecamp.org.uk is the web address. But one of the camp organizers said, look, if Gordon Brown, who's the new prime minister, wants to continue to expand the aviation industry, expand the airports, all while kind of, claiming that, we're fighting climate change, we're serious about climate change, he's going to have a real fight on his hands. Practical nonviolent direct action has had huge political effect here in the UK in the past. At the Newbury bypass site, there was this rather famous protester called Swampy who dug himself into a tunnel, which you've probably heard of, to stop this road construction project from going forward.
Yeah, and I never heard of that.
They didn't actually stop the Newbury bypass from going on, but what it did was it really put road transport squarely in the public eye as far as this is an environmental, this has huge environmental impacts. And it really delayed the construction and had kind of roll-on effects by the way people see road transport. And so it's hoped that this summer's action against Heathrow Airport will have similar effects. People will begin to see aviation for what it is, and that is, a real climate criminal.
Well, that's the hard part, is the education. I mean, I really didn't know until I read your blog, which we'll have a link to on the website. But I really didn't know that air travel was really quite that bad. That's the thing. Everybody's an environmentalist, and everybody wants to stop climate change or arrest it somehow. But people are unwilling to give up their parking spots. People are unwilling to stop flying on planes or driving their cars. So it's the educational side of it that's important, I would say. And that's what I guess you're going to be doing at Heathrow as well.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And the protest and the whole camp, I think, is not intended to target passengers or to inconvenience passengers. It's really aimed at the industry, who knows about the impact, the industry and the government.
Needs to create an alternative as well.
Exactly. And it's also going to be aimed at educating the public about the fact that aviation is so bad. And really, what I've tried to do, and I think what it's really important to do, is put a positive spin on it and say, look, being in airports is horrible. It's something we kind of grin and bear for 12 hours or whatever, to be cooped up in a plane, breathing recycled air, eating terrible food, being cramped, sitting in airport lines, just to get to somewhere that's supposed to be better than where you're at. And I think that people are increasingly aware that they can, you know, take their holidays locally, or they can take trains and boats, and the journey actually becomes part of the holiday.
Actually be able to enjoy the space in between the destinations.
Exactly. Yeah. Not flying over it at 30,000 feet. You know, putting out carbon emissions, but actually, you know, like when I was on the Amtrak train across the U.S. First I've ever been across the U.S. on land, and it's just, you know, such an amazing experience stopping in these little towns in the middle of Nebraska, and people get on, you get to talk to them about their towns and get to see, you know, people's backyards and
flyover land.
Sorry?
That's what we call flyover land, that area.
Flyover land, yeah. Coast, flyover, yes. Land actually has a lot of great communities there. Wouldn't believe that, but it's true.
Well, that's great. Is there anything else that we should talk about before we wrap it up?
Did want to talk about one brief thing, which is kind of similar to what happened in the 70s in the U.S. The government has been basically revising the highway code, which is the law about, you know, how people get around the road, and similar to the vehicle code in the States. And there's been an attempt recently to say that, you know, if there is a bike lane or a bike path, that a bicyclist has to use that, or does not have to, but the language is kind of inferring that the cyclist would be negligent if he or she did not use the side path or the bike lane. And, you know, this came up in the 70s in California when certain motoring interests wanted to get cyclists out of the way, and they had this mandatory side path law saying, you know, if there's a side path, regardless of its condition, even if there are roots sticking out of it, even if it's inconvenient and dangerous to use, you have to use it. And cycling advocates at the time successfully fought that back. And so now, you know, in California, as a result, we're allowed to use the road. And it looks like, from early reports, that a massive campaign by cyclists here in the UK has succeeded in turning back that attempted mandatory side path law. And so the highway code won't be reversed like that. So that's exciting.
So in the United States, operators of bicycles are considered maybe not vehicles, but they have all the rights and responsibilities of vehicles.
Exactly.
In the UK, that's not the case, or hasn't been?
Well, it has been the case, but there, you know, and it continues to be the case, but, you know, as in the U.S., there's always, you know, periodic attempts by, you know, people who are not as informed about, you know, bicycling safety to try and get cyclists off the road, to try and kind of erode their rights on the road. And so that's why it's so important for us, you know, as cyclists, to be aware of our rights and to exercise those rights whenever we can. So, yeah. And I guess one thing that I did want to add was that, you know, there does seem to be a real growing awareness of not only environmentalism, which was really noticeable when I arrived in the UK. It's like everyone was talking about, you know, carbon offsetting and climate change this and that. But also, you know, the role of the bicycle can play in this new regime, and, you know, allowing bicycles to really take precedence in urban areas, which I think is a key ingredient in the fight against climate change. And, you know, there has just been this interesting discussion on one of the discussion lists here in Bristol about critical mass, and some people are for it, some people are against it. You know, it's no one is kind of just neutral about critical mass, as in San Francisco and elsewhere. But someone was saying, well, you know, look, the bicycle is not a political tool, it's just a mode of transportation, you know, and, you know, some other people kind of shot back, no, it's more than that, you know, it's a symbol of a whole new way of life that is evolving in kind of a responsible way, you know, that's carbon neutral, that is, you know, more friendly in terms of urban environments. And so I think that awareness is beginning to grow here, and that's something that's really exciting.
Well, that's great, Josh. Well, I appreciate you talking to being on Bikescape. And what's the name? What's the link to your blog again?
It's on the level blog, one word, .wordpress.com.
It's a great blog. It's the whole story of your car free and airplane free trip across the half the earth.
Yeah, I tried to get from San Francisco to Bristol completely car free and plane free. And one night I had to jump into my friend's car for some Vietnamese when I was stranded at the port of Montreal. You know, so I did manage to make it plane free, and I did kind of, you know, cave in and take the car one night. But yeah, go to my blog, check it out. There's a video I just put up of the BBC coverage about my trip when I arrived. So come and visit.
You're a celebrity. All right. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for being
on. Thank you, John. Thanks for continuing to put out some great Bikescape episodes. I'm an avid listener over here in the UK, and definitely got a building critical mass of listeners over here as well. So keep up the good work.
I noticed a lot of hits out of Bristol lately. All right. Well, thanks.
All right, John. Cheers.
Okay.
Well, clocking in at 55 and a half minutes, it's a world record for Bikescape endurance. So those of you who have hung out and stuck it out this long, stay tuned because there's a surprise at the end, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But we're going to skip the news this time because there's no time for it. But I want to tell you that I'm leaving with my family to go to vacation, and we're going to take the recorder with us and the laptop. And I hope to do some podcasts out of Portland, Oregon. It'll be our first family bike trip since the kids have become old enough to ride bikes now. So we're going to put them on the trail of bikes and get on the Amtrak train up to Portland and go bike touring. Maybe about 10 miles a day, but you know, maybe more if we can pull it off. And we plan on checking out some of the great things that Portland has to offer. I'd like to check in with the people from... hopefully, I haven't contacted them yet, but City Repair, where the people that repair the streets of Oakland without any authorization, they'll do traffic calming and street furniture and all sorts of wonderful things that they dream up in their minds. Maybe we'll drop in on Chunk 666. Maybe we'll say hi to Aileen over at the bike show, the Portland bike show, I should say. There's so many things to do in Portland, and nobody knows we're coming, but we're going to surprise them all. So if you would like to stay in touch with Bikescape, make comments, criticisms, whatever, the email is bikescape@sbcglobal.net, and you can also leave comments on the blog at bikescape.blogspot.com. Please leave me comments. I love them, and maybe we can get some kind of community going out on that blog. Now, as promised, I have a little surprise. Another thing I did with the family recently was we went to Heavy Pedal Cycle Side, which is a yearly fun thing to do. There was a podcast a couple years ago now already on Bikescape about it, so check it out in the archives. But as they do every year, they had the life-size mousetrap. And if you're an American and you're about my age or younger, you probably know this wonderful game called Mousetrap with these little plastic... It's a board game when you... You earn these little plastic pieces, and eventually you have this little Rube Goldberg-type device where you put these little plastic balls in, and they go down chutes and around corners and up and down things and through the bathtub, and the little man jumps off the diving board, lands in a bucket of water, and the final thing is this little plastic net comes down over a mouse, hence the name Mousetrap. Well, in San Francisco, we have the life-size mousetrap, where we use not little plastic balls the size of your pinky, but big bowling balls. And it's a huge thing. It's about a story tall. And instead of a net coming down on a mouse, instead you have a 16-ton safe falling down on some type of object and crushing it, of course, because that's what makes it all so fun. When we saw it, it was a bicycle that got crushed, and a bunch of clowns tried to ride it away. But I understand later on in the day they dropped it on a car. It's just amazing, and you have to imagine it. There are pictures on Flickr where I will put a link. There are millions of pictures of the mousetrap on Flickr, as well as other aspects of CycleSide. But so you'll check that out. But just the audio will draw a picture in your mind. You know, I brought the family. You can hear us talking. I just happened to turn on the recorder, and it came out great. So Here it is, the life-size mousetrap.
Okay, then.
That was flawless.
That was perfect.
Was it recording? Yes.